Subject matters related to the ultimate goal of this human form of life. Our last ISKCON speaker, Mr. Sarvaish Varya Das, spoke to you on vegetarianism. As far as Krishna consciousness is concerned, we are not inordinately or over concerned with various topics such as vegetarianism, etc., etc., and many other qualities. Keshavamurti, I believe, or someone mentioned peace, attainment of peace in life, and people generally think about religion as a way of attaining peace, as a kind of, if you're feeling distressed, then you should take to religion and you will get peace in your life. If you're feeling okay anyway, then you don't need religion. That's generally the attitude. But actually, peace is simply a byproduct of spiritual life. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Nasti buddhira yuktasya na chayaktasya bhavana na cha bhavayata shantir ashantasya kuta sukham. He tells Arjuna that unless one comes to the transcendental platform, he cannot have a controlled mind or controlled senses. There are five knowledge-acquiring senses: two eyes, two ears, the nose, and the tongue, or rather sight and sound, tactile sense. So these senses are centered about the mind. And as long as the mind and the senses are uncontrolled, one cannot be peaceful in life. So by taking up spiritual life, by taking up sadhana, a man can control his mind, can control his senses, and he can become peaceful. In the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, yukta hara viharasya yukta chestasya karmasu yukta svapna vabodasya yogo bhavati dukkha. By regulation, the yogi, by regulating his eating, by regulating his sleeping habits, by regulating whatever form of recreation may be there, he can mitigate material pain, yoga bhavati dukkha. By practice of yoga, dukkha, or material suffering, can be mitigated. But ultimately, mitigation of suffering, peace of mind, etc., these are not the ultimate goals. They are simply byproducts. Just like when a man gets a disease. So, for example, say, leukemia. So there are many symptoms of that disease, leukemia. For example, one's blood changes color sometimes. Sometimes the blood becomes blue rather than red. Also, one becomes very, very weak. Also, one gets white spots on the body. So, by purchasing a cream from the marketplace and applying it on the white spots, one can get rid of the white spots, but he hasn't cured the leukemia because the white spots were only a symptom. The actual disease is a blood disease, a cancerous disease. And you have to go to the root cause. So similarly, our disturbances in this material world, there are many kinds of disturbances. Shastra describes adidaivik, adibhautik, and adhyatmik klesha. Misery is caused by adidaivik, by nature. Intense heat, or as I understand now in Tamil Nadu, there is a great drought. Or sometimes, like in Bangladesh, you don't have rain here, they have too much rain, floods, or any various manifold types of miseries caused by nature, which we can't do anything about, seemingly. Then there are miseries, adibhautik, miseries caused by other living beings, miseries caused by, as Mr. Keshav Murthy said, people who appear to be our friends but in the end cheat us. Miseries caused by other living beings, such as mosquitoes. In Coimbatore, I think I've seen the biggest mosquitoes that I've seen since I've been in India. And that's for the last 18 years. And they don't respect even Odomos. So these are adibhautik klesha, miseries caused by other living beings. And miseries, adhyatmik klesha, miseries caused by the infirmity of our own body and our own mind, troubling us. Then there are the miseries of birth, old age, disease, and death. Nobody likes to get old. One of the largest industries in the world is the cosmetics industry. People try to hide old age. In America, there are so many people who wear wigs. They're very ashamed to be bald. We can understand because wherever we go in North India, we hear the constant chant of "Hey Takla." I think they have a different chant in North and Southern India, but people are ashamed to be bald, but it's a fact of old age. Either you do it voluntarily or it happens automatically. As we get older, the hairs fall out of the body. That's a kind of infirmity of the body. The eyes become weak, the mind becomes senile. People have weak livers, people have weak kidneys, people have weak digestion. John Paul Getty, one of the richest men in the world, he couldn't eat anything. He had such weak digestion, he could only eat barley water. He had so many ulcers. Had a lot of money, couldn't enjoy it because of adhyatmic klesha. So these miseries, we can try to make adjustment to these miseries, as I said. For the mosquitoes, we can buy Odomos or get a mosquito net. For our digestion, there are so many types of churna. These are all symptoms of the real disease. The real disease is that we falsely identify the self with the body. And this is called moha, or illusion. And everyone who has come to this material world, every soul that has entered this material world, icha dvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata, he's overcome by desire, by hatred, envy. Actually, we have six major enemies: kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsaya. And these enemies make our life in this material world very miserable. They're constantly attacking us, and they're constantly putting us into illusion. Durga Devi, she is in charge of the material energy. Srishti Stiti Pralaya Sadhana Shakti Reka Chaiva Yasya Bhuvanani Vibharti Durga Ichanu Rupam Apiyasya Chacheshtatesa Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. This is a verse from the Brahma Sangita, or the prayers of Lord Brahma. So Durga Devi, her business, her duty, is to keep us here in this material world. She's the superintendent, just like you have the warden in the prison house. It's his duty to manage and control all of the prisoners. So in this material world, where we want to deny the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, where we ourselves want to assume the role of managing director, supreme in charge, controller, Ishwara. This is described in the Bhagavad Gita, that each and every one of us, in his own way, in his own circle, wants to become Ishwara. Again, Krishna says, the demoniac in the chapter, Divine and Demoniac Natures, Krishna says, Ishwaro ham aham bogi, siddoham balavan suki. The demoniac mentality is that I am the controller. Why shall I surrender to God? Why shall I surrender to Lord Krishna? I am supreme. I am the enjoyer. I am perfect. By my plans, I have so much now, and by my plans, I will get so much in the future. And if anyone gets in my way, I will kill him. And in this way, I will enjoy. So, to one degree or another, This is our basic mentality in the material world. We don't want to acknowledge the supreme dominion, the supreme control of Lord Krishna. So therefore, just like a child who approaches his mother on a moonlit night and cries out, "Mother, mother, give me the moon." So at first the mother may ignore the child's entreaty, but as the child persists, the mother, seeing no other course, relents and gives the child a mirror. So the child looks in the mirror, sees the reflection of the moon and thinks, "Oh, now I have the moon." So over here we have been given an opportunity to try to fulfill our material desires under the illusion that I am this body. If you ask any man in the street, "Sir, who are you?" he will invariably answer that, "I am Mr. Arun, I am Mr. Ashok, I am Mr. Alok, I am Indian, I am Tamilian, I am Gujarati, I am this, I am that." So many upadis he will espouse in relationship to the body. Above the body is the mind. Those who are a little more elevated than the physical platform, they identify the self with the mind. Generally great poets or great philosophers or whatever. And beyond the mind is the intelligence and ego. But to attain to that lasting platform of spiritual bliss and peace, which Lord Krishna is talking about in the Bhagavad Gita, we have to transcend the false conception of the self, the false ego, to understand the real ego, the pure ego, the transcendental ego. And that ego is that I am the eternal servant of Lord Krishna. Krishna tells Arjuna, his disciple, in the Bhagavad Gita, as Mr. Keshav Murthy said, we are all watching the Mahabharata. Now the whole purpose that Ved Vyas compiled the Mahabharata was not to create a television series on Sunday. The Mahabharata was created so that Lord Krishna could speak. The whole scenario, the whole epilogue was orchestrated because, practically speaking, just as I'm not so familiar in South India, but I have regularly visited important people in North India. I've many times been to Hindalco and various other factories around India, but I mentioned Hindalco because it's managed, or was managed in those days, by Mr. G.D. Birla, who was certainly a quite eminent managing director. So I know that although Mr. G.D. Birla, when he would go to Hindalco, they say that the first place that he would go to was the workers' bathroom. Before he would go anywhere else, he would go to the workers' toilet to see how clean that was. And that would give him some idea of what was happening in his factory. Anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is that Mr. Birla was very conscious and in control of everything going on in his factory. His order, his word, was rule everywhere. Although he was not always present everywhere, but by his instructions, he was practically present everywhere throughout his factory. But when I would go to see him at Industry House in Bombay, he used to come for a couple of hours in a day. And that also, when you would walk into his office, he had no papers on his desk, usually empty. Someone would sometimes bring in something, he'd sign it. But he was so expert at managing that everything was controlled by him. So what to speak of a tiny industry on a tiny planet in this material world. The Supreme Being, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has such complete control of everything that it is said that not a blade of grass can move without His sanction. Just try to understand. Not a blade of grass can move in the wind without the sanction of the Supreme Lord. So, His orchestration of all of the different dramas and intrigues of the Mahabharata was simply to create that battle wherein Arjuna faced his relatives, faced his gurus, his teachers, all those whom he respected. He faced them on the battlefield and he was ordered to kill them. It was his duty to march into the battle and kill them. So, the Bhagavad Gita is not a treatise on war. In fact, Vaishnavas, devotees of Lord Vishnu, Lord Krishna, they believe in ahimsa. Ahimsa paramo dharma. That this is the highest ethic, is not to commit violence, even to an ant. But here we found Arjuna, or you will be finding, I don't know if they've come to the Bhagavad Gita yet, have they? Huh? Not yet. I don't know how many, actually this Mr. Chopra has called us a number of times to try to understand how to deal with the Bhagavad Gita because it's a very difficult subject for him. Anyway, the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna is going to teach Arjuna the highest morality is to follow the instruction of the Lord. Man-made ethics, man-made morality will never suffice because it's based on relative consideration, it's based on incomplete knowledge, imperfect perception. All of our senses, which we described, the knowledge acquiring senses, they're imperfect, they're limited. We have basically, all living beings have four defects. First defect is that we make mistakes. To err is human. But to insist that those mistakes are perfect is ludicrous. We should acknowledge we're imperfect. We make mistakes, even great personalities. In your country, so many examples are there. Mahatma Gandhi, he was told, don't go to the meeting. Still he insisted. He was killed. President Kennedy in the United States, he was also warned not to go to Dallas. There are so many examples of big people who made major mistakes and were later on very sorry for it. So what to speak of them? We all make mistakes in our daily lives. Our senses are limited. We can only hear so many decibels. We can only see so far, taste so fine, touch so fine. We have a tendency to be an illusion. As I was discussing, the greatest illusion that we face is we think I am the body. I'm not the body. We think I am the body. It goes deep. I can say it. 1,000 times I can say, aham brahmasmi, aham brahmasmi, aham brahmasmi. But I'll still act as if I am the body. Because it goes very deep, just like someone who learns a language. There's a test. You know, someone may be a multilingual type of person, but you can easily find out his native tongue by, you know, kicking him in the leg, and he'll swear at you in his native language. Because it comes out. So in the same way, this attachment to the body goes very deep, and when it comes time to act, we don't have that vigyan. We talk about Vedic culture, Indian culture, but unless there is some tapasya, unless there is some vigyana, some realization, this concept that I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm an Indian, I'm a Pakistani, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Christian. See, this communalism is nothing more than bodily concept of life. Thinking I'm a Hindu is Maya. It's illusion. You're not a Hindu. You're a spirit soul. And the spirit soul is part and parcel of Allah. It's part and parcel of Jehovah. They're the same being, the same person, the same Godhead. And Krishna does not see these different materialistic distinctions. So, even though we have four kinds of defects, imperfect senses, tendency to be an illusion, make mistakes, three, the fourth one is that we'll concoct our own philosophy and then try to speak it to others as if it were the truth. We'll invent something. In my short tour, I'm actually stationed in Bombay, but in my short tour in Tamil Nadu, traveling through the villages, I've seen that people have a tendency, they're simple people, very simple and unsophisticated. They want God, they want some deity to worship, but because there's no one giving them the truth from the Shastra, they've concocted a whole pantheon of amazing imaginary deities which have no basis in Shastra or anything. So, obviously someone has concocted and preached to these people and he's simply cheating them. So the cheating propensity is there. These four defects are there by which it is not possible for us to acquire perfect knowledge. The empirical process of acquiring knowledge is defective for that reason. And therefore, the highest ethics is, as Lord Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, sarva dharman parityajam mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha ishami ma shucha. Now Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita many paths to Arjuna. He describes them, especially in the first five chapters or first six chapters. He describes jnana yoga, karma yoga, dhyana yoga. So many different yogas are described there. But at the end of the sixth chapter, he tells Arjuna, yoginam api sarvesham madgate nantaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam sami yuktatam om mataha. Of all yogis, he who simply abides in me with great faith and devotion, shraddhavan bhajate yomam sami yuktatam om mataha. My opinion is that he is the topmost yogi. And at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, just give up all your mental concoction and surrender to me. So, sometimes we see that bank robbers will steal from the bank and then they'll go outside the city and they'll say, now, let us divide all the booty up honestly. One share for you, one share for you, one share for you. Such type of man-made ethics and morality is honesty amongst thieves, but it's not very good to the people who lost their money. So we need a standard by which all men can follow, and that standard is called avaroha pantha, descending knowledge, descending standard. And that is also described by Lord Krishna in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. In the fourth chapter, he says, imam vivasvate yogam proktavanaham avyayam vivasvan manave praha manur ekshvakave bravid. Formerly, Arjuna, I instructed this knowledge to the great saintly kings such as Vivasvan, Manu, Ikshvaku. It came down by parampara. But in the course of time, that knowledge was lost. So he says, I have again appeared. The whole purpose of Krishna's appearing on the earth was to reestablish the parampara. Ultimately, the highest source of knowledge is Paramatma, the Supreme Lord, Supreme Being. As I said, he's existing everywhere. Just like who knows more about, I was going to say Hindalco, but Mr. Birla has passed away. But at that time, who knew more about Hindalco than he? Or who knows more about Visco than Mr. Keshav Murthy? Because it's his duty to know everything about every department. He's not a specialist, he knows everything about all the departments. And similarly, Krishna says, Andantarastha Paramanu Chayantarastham. He is within every atom within the creation. Anora Nihan Mahato Mahiyan. He is smaller than the smallest and he is greater than the greatest. He is the supreme intelligence. Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sanivishto Mata Smritir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. Vedaischa Sarvaya Aham Eva Vedyo Vedanta Krit Vedavit Eva Chaham. I am within in everyone's heart. Sarvasya Chaham Hridi. And from me, the living being gets his knowledge. Mata Smritir. He's able to remember because I am in his heart. I tell him what he needs to remember. Mata Smritir Gyanam Apohanam Cha. I give him knowledge and I make him forget also. When he wants to forget me, I give him the intelligence by which he can forget me. There are many wonderful atheistic philosophies in this world. Krishna inspired those men to dream up those philosophies so that they could forget him. So Krishna is the perfect authority to hear from, the perfect standard by which we should guide our lives. The perfect ethics is coming from Krishna. So when he told Arjuna to kill, the point was not killing. The point was, Arjuna, even if your duty seems to be odious, but if you want to know the righteous path, you have to see through Shastra. Now, of course, Krishna is not here today in his original form to guide us. So therefore, how are we going to decide? If someone says, you know, there are so many people nowadays, or at least some people in different parts of the world, in Ireland, not only in India, that religious violence goes on. In Ireland, in the Middle East, even in South America and in America, you will find bigots and fanatics and communalists, etc. And they're all saying that in the name of God, they're doing so many things, so many actually irreligious things. But we don't find any justification in the Shastra. In the absence of the Supreme Lord to guide you, you have to refer to Sadhu, Guru, and Shastra. These are like three parallel railroad tracks. And they say they agree with each one another. They don't disagree. The Guru never says anything that has not been said previously by the saintly persons and which cannot be corroborated by the holy scriptures. And there's no scripture in the world which will incite someone to violence over religion. No scripture in the world. And I've been through all the scriptures, the Quran, the Kabbalah, the Torah, Bible, of course. I grew up with the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita. So if we really want to know how to adjust our lives, how to attain peace and satisfaction, how to get rid of the miseries of material existence, how to be happy in this lifetime and in the next, then we have to take shelter of the Shastras, the saintly persons, the previous Acharyas, and the bona fide spiritual master. So, one aspect I wanted to speak a little bit about today was a reincarnation. Now, this is something which is very, very important, because Mr. Keshav Murthy mentioned also that it is our duty to serve the poor. And in fact, it is the duty of the haves to share what they have with the have-nots. And this is also stated in the Isha Upanishad. It's not just sentiment. The second verse of the Isha Upanishad is Isa Vasyam Idam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagacham Jagat Tena Tyaktena Bunjita magridakashasvidhanam. Everything animate and inanimate within the world is owned by, belongs to Isha. Therefore, one should respect, one should accept only that much which is set aside as his quota. One should not accept more, knowing well to whom it belongs. So in one sense, we're communists. Not that we follow Mr. Marx, but our idea is that everything belongs to Krishna, everything belongs to God, and man should accept what is his quota. There will always be rich men and there will always be poor men. Even Jesus Christ said that. The great apostle of the poor. There is a story once, someone had donated some very expensive oil to massage the body of Jesus Christ. So some of the disciples were thinking and discussing that we should sell this oil and get money and feed the poor. So Jesus heard that, and Jesus knew the principle of offering respect to the spiritual master. So he said that the poor will always be with you, but I pass this way but once. So my point is that there will always be, according to our karma, there will always be rich men and poor men. There will always be the weak and there will always be the strong. Recently I gave a lecture at Hindustan Thompson, which is an advertising agency, one of the largest in India. So they were having a discussion on leadership. So I had to first establish that even a sadhu recognizes that there is a need for some to dominate others. My Guru Maharaj used to say, the king is good for the people, and the people are good for the king. But the king is better. In other words, we need a leader in society, just like recently there was chaos in India because there was a thought that we would either have the wrong prime minister or no prime minister. So we all had to think very carefully how to vote, because we all know without a leader, without a government, without some form of leadership, there's anarchy, and everybody suffers from anarchy. So there is a verse, Ahastani Sahastanam, I quoted at Hindustan Thompson from the Srimad Bhagavatam. It is stated, Ahastani Sahastanam Apadani Chatuspadam Falguni Tatra Mahatam Jivo Jivasya Jivanam. Those who have no legs, ahastani, no hands rather, they are food for those who have hands. Apadani Chatuspadam. Those who have no legs are food for those who have four legs. Falguni Tatra Mahatam. The weak are always dominated by the strong. That's the nature of the material world. Jivo Jivasya Jivanam. One living being is food for another. So this is a fact in this material world, but we have to try to understand that although there will always be rich and poor, that people are living in this material world according to their karma, and the soul doesn't die. Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayam bhutva bhavita va anubhuyaha jo nitya shaspato yam purano na hanyate hanyamane sharire. It's the most important teaching in the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita that Lord Krishna delivers to Arjuna. For the soul, there's never birth nor death, nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He is undying, primeval, ever existing. Only the body dies. Nahanyate hanyamane sharire. The soul doesn't die. And that brings us to the subject of reincarnation. There's a video going around in Bombay. It was made by one Muslim preacher in South Africa, ridiculing all the aspects of Vedic culture, because some people like to preach their thoughts by trying to denigrate other ideas. But it's not very rational, but practically so many of the Muslims are being shown, especially the young people, because they're also in India, they're also watching Mahabharata all over, we find Christians, Muslims, Hindus, everybody is watching Mahabharata, and they're realizing what culture is there in the Vedic paradigm, the Vedic worldview, Vedic culture, Sanskriti. So to counteract this, they're trying to ridicule, and there are many things to ridicule, as I said, you know. When you think about it in the modern day, worshipping God with an elephant's head, it's hard for some people, so-called sophisticated people, to digest. Or, you know, there are so many other things. But one of the things that they find fault with is reincarnation. But amazingly enough, well, first of all, reincarnation is not amazing. Reincarnation is actually happening at every moment. Every 7 years, all the cells in your body change. This is not a Hindu fact, it's not a Hare Krishna fact, but it's a medical fact. And I have a quote here from a medical doctor, but any medical doctor can tell you the same thing. Every 7 years, all the cells in the body change, all the enzymes, all the chromosomes, everything, A to Z. Where is it?
It doesn't change, and this is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. Here you go.
Reincarnation is not an alien antipodal event, but one that occurs with regularity in our own bodies during this very lifetime. In the human brain, Professor John Pfeiffer notes, your body does not contain a single one of the molecules that it contained 7 years ago, quote unquote. Every 7 years, one's old body is completely rejuvenated. The self, however, our real identity, remains unchanged. So in effect, from boyhood to youth to middle age, dehinosmin yatha dehe komaram yovanam jara. From boyhood to youth to middle age to old age, we change our body so many times. All this, it looks similar to the old body because of the genes, the genetic code, which creates a uniform change. But the body is new. But the self, the I within the mind, the witness, he's not different. He's the same person, the same experiencing person. So in one sense, we're reincarnating every 7 years. So it's not such an amazing fact. But another amazing fact is that most people, and especially Indians who are sometimes, in every lecture I go to, many times I hear the leader of the event speaking and trying to encourage the people that our great Indian heritage. But I find that a lot of Indians, unfortunately, don't think like that. They kind of have an inferiority complex that we have to really westernize ourselves to really be accepted by the world. But you'll be surprised to know that throughout history, so many famous people have fully endorsed and believed in the concept of reincarnation. From Socrates to Salinger, of course, amongst the ancient Greeks. Well, there's just, first of all, here's a quote from Arthur Schopenhauer, who was a very famous European philosopher. He said, quote, were an Asiatic to ask me for a definition of Europe, I should be forced to answer him, it is that part of the world which is haunted by the incredible delusion that man was created out of nothing and that his present birth is his first entrance into life. Schopenhauer was a firm believer in reincarnation. Now, if we start throughout history in the ancient Greeks, Socrates, Pythagoras, and Plato, some of the founders of Pythagoras, one of the great mathematicians of all time, and Socrates and Plato, of course, two of the greatest philosophers of all time. Socrates said, I am confident that there truly is a thing, such a thing as living again, and that the living spring from the dead. Pythagoras claimed he could remember his past lives, and Plato presented detailed accounts of his reincarnation in his major works, such as Plato's Republic, one of his most famous works. There's so many descriptions of reincarnation there. Also, in Judaism, in Christianity, in Islam, there are various quotes. I won't go into those, but they are there. I have them here. If anybody wants to read them, he can. In the Middle Ages, there were many famous men, even the early Christians. Amongst their writings, some of the most famous were, there was one famous Italian philosopher, Giordano Bruno. We have one Italian with us here today. I don't know if he's heard of Mr. Bruno, but he was a famous early Christian philosopher. He was ultimately sentenced to death. He was burned at the stake for his teaching of reincarnation in Christianity. And he said at his trial that the soul is not the body, and it may be in one body or in another and pass from body to body. Then later on in the Age of Enlightenment, Voltaire said that the doctrine of reincarnation is neither absurd nor useless, adding, it is not more surprising to be born twice than once. Later on in American history, Benjamin Franklin, I'm sure you've all heard of Benjamin Franklin, very famous American statesman and philosopher. So Benjamin Franklin wrote, finding myself to exist in the world, I believe I shall, in some shape or other, always exist. The very one of the earliest presidents of the United States was John Adams. So in 1814, he wrote to none other than Thomas Jefferson, also very famous American, whom many people glorify for his writings on freedom and etc. So he wrote to Thomas Jefferson that down to the regions, pardon me, after revolting against the Supreme Being, some souls were hurled down to the regions of total darkness. They were then released from prison, permitted to ascend to earth and migrate into all sorts of animals, reptiles, birds, beasts, and men, according to their rank and character, and even into vegetables and minerals, there to serve on probation. If they passed without reproach their several graduations, they were permitted to become crows, cows, and men. As men they behaved well, they were restored to their original rank and bliss in heaven. Now this was the President of the United States. And there were many other such personalities in that period. Napoleon also, very famous Frenchman, he used to often tell his generals that in his previous life he was King Charlemagne. Jonathan Wolfgang von Goethe, a great German poet, also wrote in many of his literatures, I am certain that I have been here as I am now 1,000 times before, and I hope to return 1,000 times. I hope to return 1,000 times. Emerson, Whitman, Thoreau, so many famous American poets and philosophers espoused the idea of reincarnation. Count Leo Tolstoy, Charles Dickens, Aldous Huxley. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's so many in this book, I couldn't read them all to you today. But it is a fact that these ideas have been accepted by thinking men throughout history, throughout the world. But the greatest scientific presentation of these ideas, and I said these are very important ideas, we're talking about the poor. So one thing is to understand why people are poor, why people are suffering. The fact is that in a previous life, because of some sinful activity, they have taken birth again and are now suffering. So one way to help them is to give them temporary remedial relief, no doubt. And it's the duty of householders to do that, those who have money and compassion in their heart, good God's compassion, they should share what they have with others. But to do that without giving them some knowledge of the reason why they're suffering and how they can mitigate their suffering permanently is only a patchwork solution. It's not a very good solution. And in order to instruct people, we ourselves should know a little bit about the philosophy of reincarnation. We should know about Bhagavad Gita. We should know about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we should have some kind of understanding ourselves. Otherwise, our instructions, of course, will all go in vain. So, these instructions, especially in the Bhagavad Gita, are very sanguine, very expertly presented. Bhagavad Gita is like, you might say, the handbook of spiritual knowledge. It is like a postgraduate study in spiritual science. The essence of spiritual teaching is explained very succinctly. He didn't have much time. He only had about 1 hour, less than that. You can imagine in the middle of the battlefield, the two armies are ready to tear at each other, and Arjuna halts everything and says, wait a minute, I have to think. How much time are they going to give him to think? So Krishna didn't have much time. So he explained very succinctly the essence, but in a very nice, easy way that any man can understand. But I just don't know how many of us today have ever read the full Bhagavad Gita and studied it. That's the problem. India has a great culture. They have a great tradition, a great heritage. But today's Indians, maybe not your generation, maybe your generation. I know the next generation, very few know. And I've many occasions I ask, especially when I go to schools, about 3 weeks ago I was at one school, and I asked one student, I pointed them out, sir, stand up. Have you read the Bhagavad Gita? This was after my lecture. And, you know, in front of all his peers, he was feeling maybe a little embarrassed. Whatever, he lied. He said, yes. I said, did you read the 25th chapter of Bhagavad Gita? He said, yes. I said, sir, there are only 18 chapters. How did you read the 25th chapter? So, unless we actually make a little effort to understand what is there in the Shastra, to hear from the devotees of the Lord, because just like you want to learn anything, if you want to learn chemistry, you go to a chemist. You want to learn medicine, you go to a doctor. You want to learn business, you go to a businessman or business school or whatever. You go to an authority in the field. People somehow or other have the idea that whatever, when it comes to spiritual knowledge, they think, well, whatever I think is as good as whatever anybody else thinks. It's all whimsical, capricious, arbitrary, right? Jatamat tatapat, any path leads to the same goal. But that's not a fact. In fact, spiritual knowledge is even more scientific. It's more subtle. It needs more description than physical organic knowledge. Spiritual knowledge needs more clarification because it's sukshma, it's very subtle, hard to quantify, hard to identify. So therefore, we have to approach the Shastras, we have to approach the devotees and get the actual path. Otherwise, we see this khichdi, like you see in India today. Under the banner of Hinduism, you can practically do anything and call yourself a Hindu. And I'm telling you, the other people outside India, they ridicule like anything. And we give them that ammunition because we ourselves haven't taken the trouble to there is philosophy, there's very profound philosophy in the Vedas, especially in the Bhagavad Gita. It's very easy, it's for all of us, but we don't take the trouble. And therefore we find, you know, people worshipping anything and everything. Cockroaches, rats, this, that, trees, ghosts, and they call themselves Hindus, and, you know, it's very silly, actually. But there is something great there, but unless you find out and, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Bharat Bhumite Hoila Manusa Janma Jar. I don't know if you can understand Bengali. It's similar to Tamil, but Bharat Bhumite Hoila Manusa Janma Jar. Those who have taken birth in India, they're very fortunate. It's the end of the human evolution. Actually, the soul is evolving. Chaurasi Lakh Yoni Ke Baad, after going through 8,400,000 species of life, we get an opportunity of human birth. So this is a very rare opportunity. There are only 400,000 species of human birth. And out of that, there are very few civilized forms. And out of that, to be born in Bharat Varsha, Tapa Bhumi, the land of Gautama, the land of Bharadvaj, the land of Rishabdev, the land of Yudhisthira, and you know, it goes on and on and on. So many great scientists in the spiritual field, great scholars, research scientists. To be born here, it's very auspicious. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu glorifies this birth, Bharat Bhumite Hoila Manusa Janma Jar, but he qualifies, Janma Sartak Kari Kara Paropakar. Then do welfare work. First perfect your life. You see? Then help others. And there's many ways to help, both physical and spiritual, but they should go hand in hand. So I've taken a lot of your time, and I'll stop there. I thank you very much. I hope you will take some of our books, because I'm in a short lecture, and neither I'm very good at speaking, nor can I explain much in a short time. But there's so much there in our books. They're very reasonably priced, and you owe it to yourself to at least go through them. You're all intelligent men. I'm told that your managing director pays you very good wages, good bonus, everything. Your company is famous for its dividends to shareholders and employees alike. So you have enough to buy our books. Please take some. And Hare Krishna, thank you.